Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 7th Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Audit: Fraud Cost State $73 Million by Alex Burness. Denver: City Council votes to ban most flavored tobacco and vaping products starting in 23 by Joe Rubino. Olympics in China. U.S. plans diplomatic boycott of games by Amir Madhani and Alexander Jaffe. Threats from Russia. On Ukrainian front, grinding war and weary anticipation of invasion by Michael Schwartz. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Audit: Fraud cost state $73 million. Colorado improperly paid out jobless benefits, including to dead people, by Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Colorado paid out about $73 million in fraudulent unemployment benefits during the first year of the pandemic, and also failed to resolve the vast majority of customer complaints related to unemployment insurance fraud, a state audit found. The Office of the State Auditor reported improper payments included $3.9 million to dead people, $5 million to incarcerated people who aren't eligible to work, and $102,000 to people under the age of 18. Auditors wrote that unemployment fraud not only wastes taxpayer money, but that Colorado could also be forced to pay back the federal government for improper payments. And, the audit noted, these newly reported figures may paint an incomplete picture of the problem. It may take years before the state has final statewide and nationwide totals for fraudulent payments, the audit stated. Colorado's Department of Labor and Employment has said the amount of unemployment insurance fraud here is sure to increase as we continue to investigate and verify. The report comes as unemployment claims have skyrocketed in the state, as elsewhere, since March 2020 when the coronavirus was first detected in Colorado. In a state of about 6 million people, some 852,000 Coloradans received unemployment payments totaling $6.9 billion last year, the state reports. And in 2021, through October, 577,000 Coloradans had received those payments, totaling $4.6 billion. That has put significant strain on a system not accustomed to such volume. 1 week's worth of unemployment claims in April 2020, when unemployment reached 12% in the state, exceeded total claims in all of 2019. On Monday, the state legislature's audit committee met to hear the findings of the new report, but opted to hold discussion in a confidential session closed off to the media and general public. The committee's chair, Commerce City Democratic State Representative Daphne Michelson-Janay, said the closed session was necessary to discuss strategies to thwart bad actors. "My message to fraudsters is, go find another state," she told the Denver Post. "I'm feeling very confident about the new tools we're going to be using and about how they'll not only be able to help us resolve current open claims, but prevent future ones." Colorado is not alone in reporting massive unemployment benefits fraud. Its $73 million problem is small compared to some states' reported fraudulent payments, $4.4 billion in Arizona, more than $600 million in Washington, $462 million in Ohio, and $380 million in Kansas, according to the auditor's report. California, with more than seven times the population of Colorado, this fall reported at least $20 billion in unemployment fraud. That Colorado is doing better compared to other states, Michelson Janay said, is not a reason not to try to fix our system. Because of so much fraud, the Department of Labor and Employment place holds on hundreds of thousands of unemployment insurance claims in order to investigate validity. In 266,000 instances in which someone whose claim was placed on hold requested assistance, only 70,000 were ever resolved, the auditor reported. Among that subset, it took the department an average of 7 weeks to reach a resolution, though the auditor notes that wait times range as high as 333 days. Fraud must be stopped, but efforts there should not force legitimate claimants to wait so long for relief, said Jenny Page, a state auditor who worked on the report. It's important to protect taxpayer resources by having measures in place to prevent and detect fraudulent claims, she said. But it's also important to have effective processes in place to assist those individuals whose legitimate claims may have been put on hold as a result of these same fraud prevention and detection measures. The audit recommended better quality control on complaints, stating, as a state agency that serves the public, it is reasonable to expect that the department would have complaint management processes that include consistent methods to track, investigate, and resolve complaints in a manner that ensures that they do not recur. In response to the audit, the Department of Labor and Employment accepted that recommendation and claimed that by March of 2022, it plans to have a system in effect for tracking, investigating, and resolving all complaints, timely and managing data about the resolutions. The department also said it is taking other steps to better track and analyze customer complaints. Denver. City Council votes to ban most flavored tobacco vaping products starting in 23, by Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. The Denver City Council approved a ban on most flavored tobacco and vaping products Monday night. Come July 2023, the only places adults will be able to legally buy any flavored smokables in the city will be at hookah lounges or shops selling pipe tobacco and handmade cigars. The flavor ban ordinance passed by a vote of 8-3 Monday. Council members Kevin Flynn, who sought to amend the measure to exempt menthol products, and Chris Herndon, who opposed it in its entirety, were absent. The vote brings to a close months-long debate between council members who argued that limiting access to flavored products was essential to fighting youth smoking and vaping, and members who viewed the ban as government overreach more likely to hurt small business owners than make a dent in the youth nation's vaping epidemic. This really is about public health, and we make those decisions based not on positions of power and who contributes to the tax base, but it's really about limiting harm, Councilwoman Jamie Torres said prior to voting yes. Kids aren't property owners and kids aren't business owners. Council members Amanda Sawyer and Debbie Ortega co-sponsored the bill. It took three committee meetings and a public hearing in the council chamber on November 29th to reach Monday's outcome. Along the way, the bill was watered down in some places, but held strong in others. Sawyer and Ortega accepted amendments that exempted hookah lounges that only serve customers 21 and up, and another one that carved out an exemption for pipe tobacco and handmade cigars. The tobacco used in hookahs, tall water pipes that have been used in Middle Eastern cultures going back centuries, is always flavored, so a ban would have effectively shut down roughly 20 businesses in the city if they had not been exempted. Councilman Paul Cashman brought the pipe, and cigar amendment, noting that many of those products also have flavoring agents in them. Cashman's rationale for the amendment is that the ordinances focus on preventing youth smoking. "I don't know kids walking around with nasty old stogies," he said at last month's council hearing. The new ban left several groups feeling burned. Opponents included owners of smoking and vaping-focused small businesses and some members of Denver's Black community that viewed banned mentholated smoking products as a paternalistic attack on their personal choices. Phil Guerin, the owner of the Mixed Up Creations smoke shop on East Colfax Avenue, attended multiple hearings to argue against the ban. He claims to have helped thousands of adults stop smoking by giving them an alternative through vaping products. "The ban will undermine more people's efforts to quit. You're acting like we don't even exist," Guerin said at Monday night's meeting. "You guys could have come to me and we could have addressed this as a community. I have solutions." A proposed amendment from Councilwoman Kendra Black that would have exempted 21 and up smoke shops that check IDs was voted down during the bill's initial council hearing. Flynn's amendment that would have exempted menthol-flavored products also lost on a split vote last month. Community activist Alvertus Simmons was among those who argued for that, decrying the council for exempting hookah lounges in part because of their cultural significance while targeting menthol largely because of its prevalence among Black smokers. "At some point, City Council, you are going to have to come to the realization that Black folks got our own mind," Simmons said. "You talk about equity, you've got to be equitable." One amendment that did make it in at last month's council hearing was a year delay in implementation. Rather than going into effect on July 1, 2022, the ban will start on July 1, 2023, giving small business owners more time to adapt. That amendment was also put forth by Cashman, who ultimately voted no on the ban. On Monday, Councilman Jolan Clark said he hoped the additional time might allow the city to explore enacting stricter penalties for smoke shops that sell to underage consumers and other regulator avenues for addressing youth use. Ideally, he said, he'd like the city to get to a place where it could revisit the exemption for 21 and up smoke shops. He voted yes on the ban. Some council members remain skeptical of the ban's value. Denver becomes the seventh Colorado municipality to limit the sale of flavored tobaccos and vape products. But it has neighbors on all sides that don't limit those sales, leaving the door open for people to obtain them elsewhere and still possibly pass them on to kids. There is nothing in this legislation that would stop someone from going to Aurora or Commerce City and buying menthol cigarettes and selling them in a park in Denver, Council President Stacey Gilmore said during the November 29th public hearing. Gilmore voted no Monday. "I frankly am very concerned about the unintended consequences that we haven't fully explored and delved into as a council." Olympics in China. U.S. plans diplomatic boycott of games, by Amir Madhani and Alexander Jaffe. The Associated Press. Byline, Washington. The U.S. will stage a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Winter Olympics in Beijing to protest Chinese human rights abuses, the White House confirmed Monday, a move that China has vowed to greet with firm countermeasures. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said U.S. athletes will continue to compete and will have our full support, but added, "We will not be contributing to the fanfare of the games." U.S. diplomatic or official representation would treat these games as business as usual in the face of the PRC's egregious human rights abuses and atrocities in Xinjiang, and we simply can't do that, Psaki told reporters during Monday's briefing. "We have a fundamental commitment to promoting human rights, and we feel strongly in our position, and we will continue to take actions to advance human rights in China and beyond." The announcement came as Biden prepares to host a White House Summit for Democracy, a virtual gathering of leaders and civil society experts from more than 100 countries that is set to take place Thursday and Friday. The administration has said Biden intends to use the meeting to announce both individual and collective commitments, reforms, and initiatives to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Robert Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, called such a diplomatic boycott a necessary step to demonstrate our unwavering commitment to human rights in the face of the Chinese government's unconscionable abuses. He called on other allies and partners that share our values to join with the United States in this diplomatic boycott. Senator Tom Cotton, an Arkansas Republican, however, said the diplomatic boycott amounted to a half measure. American officials, including Biden, have criticized Beijing for human rights abuses against Uyghurs in northwest Xinjiang province, suppression of democratic protests in Hong Kong, military aggression against the self-ruled island of Taiwan, and more. President Donald Trump's administration, in its final days, declared the abuses in northwest China genocide. The United States should fully boycott the genocide games in Beijing, Cotton said. American businesses should not financially support the Chinese Communist Party, and we must not expose Team USA to the dangers of a repugnant authoritarian regime that disappears its own athletes. Cotton appeared to be referring to former Grand Slam doubles champion Peng Shuai, who dropped from sight after publicly accusing a former top Communist Party official of sexual assault. Concerns over her safety prompted the Women's Tennis Association to suspend events in China and provided added fuel to opponents of China's hosting of the games. Saki would not comment whether Biden weighed pulling athletes from the games, many of whom have been training for years for the moment to compete on the global stage. In 1980, in the midst of the Cold War, Jimmy Carter kept U.S. athletes home from the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow to protest the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. I don't think that we felt it was the right step to penalize athletes who have been training and preparing for this moment, and we felt that we could send a clear message by not sending an official U.S. delegation, Saki said. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian accused U.S. politicians of grandstanding over the issue of not sending dignitaries to attend events that China hopes will showcase its economic development and technological prowess. Speaking to reporters at a daily briefing, Zhao said such a move would be an outright political provocation, but gave no details on how China might retaliate. Human rights advocates and lawmakers in the U.S. who support a boycott say it is a necessary step. They cite China's poor record on human rights as justification, saying China is using the games to whitewash its ill treatment of civil rights activists, political dissidents, and ethnic minorities. Without being invited, American politicians keep hyping the so-called diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics, which is purely wishful thinking and grandstanding, Zhao told reporters at a daily briefing. If the U.S. side is bent on going its own way, China will take firm countermeasures. The International Olympic Committee, in a statement, called the decision to keep dignitaries away from the game a political decision for each government that it fully respects. At the same time, this announcement also makes it clear that the Olympic Games and the participation of the athletes are beyond politics, and we welcome this, the IOC statement said. The dispatching of high-level delegations to each Olympics has long been a tradition among the U.S. and other leading nations. Then-President George W. Bush attended the opening of the 2008 Beijing Olympic Summer Games. First Lady Jill Biden led the American contingent to the Summer Olympics in Tokyo this year. And Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff led a delegation to the Paralympic Games. The diplomatic boycott comes as the U.S. attempts to stabilize turbulent relations with Beijing, even as it maintains a tough approach toward trade and conflicts over China's actions on Taiwan, human rights, Hong Kong, and the South China Sea. Threats from Russia. On Ukrainian front, Grinding War and Weary Anticipation of Invasion by Michael Schwirtz, The New York Times Company, byline, Avdiivka, Ukraine. Machine gun fire broke the stillness just after 8 p.m. when Captain Denis Brenitsky was midway through the evening patrol. The shots came in sporadic bursts and were close by, fired by Russian-backed separatists whose positions were obscured in the darkness. Only when the flash of a rocket-propelled grenade illuminated the newly fallen snow did Brenitsky break his stride, briefly pausing to take cover before moving on. "This happens every night," said Brenitsky, a cleft-chinned company commander with the Ukrainian military's 25th Airborne Brigade, positioned along the front lines in eastern Ukraine. "Sometimes it's much heavier. Sometimes it's like tonight. Tonight, this is fine." This is what the war has been like for years, a slow, bloody grind that set in after both sides fought to a stalemate over territory seized by Russian-backed forces in 2014. Now, Ukrainian and Western officials say something more ominous could be building. In recent weeks, they have warned that Russia was erecting the architecture for significant military action, possibly even a full-fledged invasion. American intelligence officials have assessed that Moscow has drawn up plans for a military offensive involving an estimated 175,000 troops to begin as early as next year. Recent satellite photos show a buildup in equipment, including tanks and artillery. President Vladimir Putin of Russia has countered that it was the Ukrainians with their American and Western European backers who were instigating a war, citing what he calls security threats to Russia, including NATO exercises in the Black Sea. Amid mounting anxiety, Putin and President Joe Biden will speak by video conference Tuesday. The White House said Biden would reaffirm the United States' support for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. Putin has made his position clear. "It is not we who are threatening anyone," he said last week. "And accusing us of this, given the reality on the ground, or as we say, to shift the blame from the person who's sick in the head to the healthy one, is at minimum irresponsible. For the fighters dug into an ant farm of muddy trenches on both sides of the conflict in Ukraine, talk of a new war might seem puzzling. For them, the old one never ended. A 2015 ceasefire between the Ukrainian government and the Russian-backed forces in two separatist enclaves brought an end to the most serious hostilities in the conflict that has cost more than 13,000 lives. But it did not bring peace. What is known as the line of contact separating the two sides regularly crackles with gunfire, punctuated with an occasional boom of artillery. A handful of Ukrainian soldiers is killed each month, mostly by sniper fire. There were 7 in September, 2 in October, and 6 in November. Last week, a 22-year-old soldier named Valery Heroskvin became the first killed in December. So far, soldiers on the front lines said they had seen little evidence of escalation beyond this largely slow-moving war of attrition. Compared with the vicious fighting that preceded it, this is a holiday, several soldiers said. But after 8 years in the trenches, there is a weary acceptance that the status quo cannot last forever, that the Russian military, which dwarfs their own in power and wealth, will likely come sooner or later. "If that moment is now at hand," they said, "so be it. I studied at university, and my head is screwed on right, so I recognize perfectly well the danger the Russian army presents and that no one can guarantee that Putin or anyone else won't suddenly say, 'Forward,'" said First Lieutenant Ivan Skuratovsky, a stoic 30-year-old father of two who has been fighting since war broke out in 2014. "We're prepared for this turn of events because this is our job, and none but us is in a position to confront this threat. Are we scared of an open offensive?" he added. "I just don't see that in people." The soldiers are on heightened alert anyway, aware that in this period of explosive tensions, an errant bullet or mortar shell could be all that is needed to touch off a serious escalation. Even when fired upon, they are under strict orders not to respond unless absolutely necessary. If a full-on attack comes, Ukrainian forces are as ready to face it as they've ever been, said General Oleksandr Paluyev, commander of the Joint Forces Operation battling the separatists. But even this, he acknowledged, will not be enough to hold off the Russian military without significant assistance from Western countries, specifically the United States. Some military analysts have said that, faced with a full invasion by vastly superior forces, Ukraine would at best manage an organized retreat. Pavlovic cited the many citizens in Ukraine with military experience and suggested the conflict might evolve to something akin to insurgency, with Ukrainians fighting the Russians block by block and house by house. But the war would take a disastrous toll. This is a beast who has tasted blood, Paluyuk said. Believe me, the losses are going to be horrible on both sides. Thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands on their side and ours. For those on the front charged with paying attention, there is a subtle but palpable change in the air, even if unnoticed by regular soldiers. In the last month or month and a half, everything has become more frequent, said a masked and helmeted military intelligence commander who would only give his name as Ilya. Shelling is more frequent from both artillery and small arms. Drones have started flying more often. And if before they did not drop bombs, now they've come up with a system for doing so. It's a full-on activization. Investigation into 1955 lynching closed by feds. Byline, Jackson, Mississippi. The U.S. Justice Department told relatives of Emmett Till on Monday that it is ending its latest investigation into the 1955 lynching of the black teenager from Chicago who was abducted, tortured, and killed after witnesses said he whistled at a white woman in Mississippi. Till's family said it was disappointed that there will continue to be no accountability for the killing, with no charges being filed against Carolyn Bryant Donham. The killing galvanized the civil rights movement after Till's mother insisted on an open casket, and Jet magazine published photos of his brutalized body. The Justice Department reopened the investigation after a 2017 book quoted Donham as saying she lied when she claimed that the 14-year-old Till grabbed her, whistled, and made sexual advances while she was working in a store in the small community of Money. Relatives have publicly denied that Donham, who was in her 80s, recanted her allegations about Till. Donham told the FBI she had never recanted her accusations and there is insufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she lied to the FBI, the Justice Department said Monday. Two white men, Roy Bryant and his half-brother, J.W. Milham, were tried on murder charges about a month after Till was killed, but an all-white Mississippi jury acquitted them. Months later, they confessed in a paid interview with Look magazine. Bryant was married to Donham in 1955. This was from the Associated Press. Bob Dole to lie in state at Capitol. Byline, Washington. Senator Bob Dole's casket will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol on Thursday as congressional leaders honor the former Republican presidential candidate and World War II veteran who served in Congress for 36 years. Dole died Sunday at the age of 98. He was a leader known for his caustic wit, which he often turned on himself, but didn't hesitate to turn on others, too. He shaped tax and foreign policy and worked vigorously to help the disabled, enshrining protections against discrimination in employment, education, and public services in the Americans with Disabilities Act. The U.S. Capitol has been considered the most suitable place for the nation to pay final tribute to its most eminent citizens by having their remains lie in state. The commemoration will include a formal arrival and departure ceremony. Senator Dole was an extraordinary patriot who devoted his entire life to serving our nation with dignity and integrity, said House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat of California. This is from the Associated Press. In news briefs, Germany gets gender-equal cabinet, Beilein, Berlin. For the first time in 16 years, Germany will be run by a man. But although Angela Merkel is handing over the chancellery to a male successor, the incoming cabinet will have more women than ever before, half to be exact. Olaf Scholz, the incoming chancellor, kept his election promise to appoint as many women as men to his government. And not only that, women will run all the briefs related to security and diplomacy. Germany will have its first female foreign minister and its first female interior minister. It will also get its third female defense minister in a row. U.S. religious group says Haitian gang releases three hostages. Byline, Port-au-Prince, Haiti. A religious group based in Ohio announced Monday that a violent gang in Haiti has released three more hostages, while another 12 remain abducted. The statement from Christian Aid Ministries said the people were released on Sunday in Haiti and are safe and seem to be in good spirits. The group provided no further details. On November 21st, the religious organization announced that the 400 Mawozo gang had released the first two hostages of a group of 17 kidnapped in mid-October. Nunes will quit U.S. House to take over Trump's media company, Byline, Washington. Representative Devin Nunes, a California Republican who emerged as one of former President Donald Trump's most loyal and pugnacious allies, announced on Monday that he would resign from Congress after 19 years to become CEO of Trump's new media and technology company. Nunes faced difficult odds in being reelected to the Central Valley District that his family had farmed for three generations. A new map emerging from an independent citizens redistricting commission was almost certain to flip it from a district Trump won handily to one President Joe Biden would have won. Unvaccinated Italians face new restrictions as holidays near. Byline, Milan. Italy is making life more uncomfortable for unvaccinated people this holiday season, excluding them from indoor restaurants, theaters, and museums starting Monday to reduce the spread of coronavirus and encourage vaccine skeptics to get their shots. Italian police have been empowered to check whether diners in restaurants or bars have a super green health pass certifying that they are either vaccinated or have recently recovered from the virus. Microsoft seizes 42 websites from a Chinese hacking group. Microsoft said Monday that it had seized 42 websites from a Chinese hacking group in an effort to disrupt the group's intelligence gathering operations. The company said in a news release that a federal court in Virginia had granted Microsoft's request to allow its digital crimes unit to take over the U.S.-based websites, which were being run by a hacker group known as Nickel or Apt 15. The company is redirecting the website's traffic to secure Microsoft servers to help us protect existing and future victims while learning more about Nickel's activities. India and Russia expand defense ties. Byline, New Delhi. India and Russia announced expanding defense ties Monday during a visit by President Vladimir Putin to New Delhi, including a $5.4 billion missile defense system sale to India, despite a risk of sanctions from the United States. Supplies have begun this month and will continue to happen, India's Foreign Secretary Harsh Vardhan Shringla said. These were from Denver Post Wire reports. Redistricting. Justice Department sues Texas over new maps by Acacia Coronado and Nicholas Riccardi. The Associated Press, Byline, Austin, Texas. The Justice Department sued Texas on Monday over its new redistricting maps, saying the plans discriminate against minority voters, particularly Latinos, who have fueled the state's population boom. The lawsuit claims the Republican-controlled state violated part of the Voting Rights Act in drawing new district boundaries for its congressional delegation and state legislature. It's the Biden Justice Department's first legal action challenging a state's maps since states began redrawing their maps this year to account for population changes. The lawsuit notes that most of Texas's population growth over the past decade came from Black, Latino, and Asian people, but alleges that the new maps drawn by state Republicans dilute these communities' votes by denying them opportunities to choose their representatives. It says the maps pack Black and especially Latino communities into bizarre-shaped districts. A Dallas area one is described as seahorse-shaped, while preserving seats for white Republicans. This is not the first time that Texas has acted to minimize the voting rights of its minority citizens. Associate Attorney General Vinita Gupta said during a news conference with Attorney General Merrick Garland, decade after decade, courts have found that Texas has enacted redistricting plans that deliberately dilute the voting strength of Latino and Black voters and that violate the Voting Rights Act. The litigation comes as Republicans and Democrats jockey for an edge in the once-a-decade redistricting process, which has already reached new levels of gerrymandering. The lawsuit also plays out during a changed legal landscape for redistricting challenges. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2019 that it won't referee partisan gerrymandering disputes, maps drawn to benefit a political party. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, a Republican, condemned the litigation as an intrusion by the Democratic administration. The Department of Justice's absurd lawsuit against our state is the Biden administration's latest ploy to control Texas voters, Paxton tweeted. I am confident that our legislature's redistricting decisions will be proven lawful, and this preposterous attempt to sway democracy will fail. Monday's lawsuit, filed in the Western District of Texas, cites several congressional districts in which Republicans drew tortured lines to lower the share of Black and Latino voters in their party's congressional districts. COVID-19 vaccines. New York City to put mandate on private sector employers by Michelle L. Price, Bobby Kana Calvin, and Karen Matthews, The Associated Press, Byline, New York. From a big Wall Street bank to corner grocery stores, all private employers in New York City will have to require their workers to get vaccinated against COVID-19, the mayor announced, in the most sweeping vaccine mandate of any state or big city in the U.S. The move by Mayor Bill de Blasio comes as cases are climbing again in the U.S., and the worrisome but little understood Omicron variant is gaining a toehold in the nation's largest city and elsewhere around the country. We in New York City have decided to use a preemptive strike to really do something bold to stop the further growth of COVID and the dangers it's causing to all of us, he said. De Blasio, a Democrat with just weeks left in office, said the mandate will take effect December 27th, with in-person workers needing to provide proof they have received at least one dose of the vaccine. And they will not be allowed to get out of the requirement by agreeing to regular COVID-19 testing instead. The measure will apply to roughly 184,000 businesses not covered by previous vaccine mandates, ranging from multinational corporations to mom-and-pop businesses in the city of 8.8 million people, according to a spokesperson for the mayor. The city's private sector workforce is 3.7 million. Also, anyone 12 or older who wants to dine indoors at a restaurant, go to a gym, or see a show will have to produce proof of having received two shots of the vaccine, up from the current requirement of one dose, the mayor said. And children 5 to 11 will have to show proof of at least one shot. De Blasio said the moves are aimed at staving off a spike of infections amid holiday gatherings and the cold weather, which drives more people indoors, where the virus can spread more easily. Phil Penta, who runs a specialty grocery store called Three Guys from Brooklyn, said the impending mandate could put him in a bind by forcing him to fire valued employees who are holding out against the vaccine. Everybody wants to do the right thing, but the right thing is different for everybody, said Penta, who said the vast majority of his roughly 36 employees have been vaccinated. He added, I respect the right to say they don't want to take it. Vaccine rules across states and cities vary widely, with some states resisting any mandates and others requiring the shots for government employees or certain sectors that run a particularly high risk, such as healthcare workers. But no state has announced a broad private sector mandate like New York City's, according to data compiled by the nonpartisan National Academy for State Health Policy. President Joe Biden sought to impose a less far-reaching mandate nationally, requiring employees of businesses with 100 or more workers to either get vaccinated or undergo regular testing. But federal courts have blocked that plan for now, ahead of the January 4th deadline. De Blasio said he expects his mandate to survive any legal challenges. Employees will be able to ask for religious or medical exemptions. The mayor said he will release more details next week about how the mandate will be enforced. About 5.9 million adults in New York City have gotten at least a first dose out of 7 million people age 18 and up. That translates to 84%. About 5.8 million New Yorkers of all ages are fully vaccinated. Cases of the Omicron variant have been reported in about one-third of the states, but scientists cannot say for certain yet whether it is more dangerous than previous versions. U.S. health experts have strongly urged people to get their shots and a booster, saying they believe the vaccine will still offer protection against the new variant. The Delta variant still accounts for practically all infections in the U.S., and a rise in cases in recent weeks has swamped hospitals, especially in the Midwest and New England. New York City is averaging just under 2,000 new cases of COVID-19 per day, up from about 820 a day at the start of November. Vaccination is the central weapon in this war against COVID. It's the one thing that has worked every single time across the board, de Blasio said at a virtual news conference. A lot of folks to me in the private sector have said to me they believe in vaccination, but they're not quite sure how they can do it themselves, he continued. Well, we're going to do it. Vaccinations are already required in New York City for hospital and nursing home workers and for city employees, including teachers, police officers, and firefighters. A vaccination mandate for employees of private and religious schools was announced last week. Some other private sector employees, including those at restaurants, gyms, theaters, and other entertainment sites, were also required to be vaccinated under rules issued earlier by the mayor. COVID-19 cases, hospital data is stable. Modeler, Colorado has window of opportunity to get virus under control ahead of Christmas, by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. Colorado's COVID-19 hospitalizations and cases were stable or improving as of Monday, though it won't be clear until later this week if the virus spread across Thanksgiving tables. As of Monday afternoon, 1,379 people were hospitalized statewide with confirmed COVID-19, according to data from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. That's a small uptick, 11 people from Friday. New hospital admissions are still dropping, though, which suggests hospitalizations will continue to trend in the right direction, said Beth Carlton, an associate professor of environmental and occupational health at the Colorado School of Public Health and a member of the state's COVID-19 modeling team. Cases recorded in the week ending Sunday rose by more than 900 compared to the previous week, not unexpected since a lack of testing over holidays tends to depress case counts. Fewer people tested positive than in the third week of November, however, and the percentage of tests coming back positive remained relatively stable. That suggests the situation at least isn't getting worse. It doesn't mean that the good times have returned, though. Half of the hospitals reporting to the state said they expect to be short-staffed in the next week. and about 94% of intensive care beds are full, a significant improvement from a week ago, but still well above the normal level of roughly 80% of capacity. The overall positive trends mean that Colorado has a window of opportunity to drive down cases and hospitalizations before people gather for the end of year holidays, Carlton said. It's much safer to gather when community transmission is low, she said. So far, there's no sign that the new Omicron variant is making much of an impact in Colorado. The state has confirmed only two cases, both in people who recently had traveled to southern Africa. The variant has spread quickly around the world, reaching at least 18 states and more than 50 countries, and may be driving a spike in cases in South Africa. Early data from South Africa suggests Omicron may be more contagious than the Delta variant, which currently accounts for almost all COVID-19 cases in Colorado. A small study of 166 people with Omicron found they generally had mild symptoms, but that was a young group, so that may not reflect the risk to those who are at a higher risk for severe disease. Experts believe that vaccines will continue to be effective at preventing severe disease from Omicron, and that people who have received a booster shot will have more protection. The world is still waiting for data on whether the level of protection from vaccines takes any hit from the new variant, though. While Omicron isn't widespread in Colorado at this point, and the flu season has been mild so far, it's a good idea to get vaccinated against both viruses and get a COVID-19 booster if enough time has passed, Carlton said. While the hospital situation is improving, there isn't much spare capacity to deal with a patient influx. We don't want to layer Omicron on top of everything, she said. Reform Coalition calls for greater equity in how organizations distribute funding for victim services, by Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. A Colorado nonprofit organization on Tuesday called for change after finding the state's ecosystem for supporting victims in the aftermath of crime is dominated by groups and funders led and staffed largely by white people. There's a stark lack of diversity among the people making decisions about what organizations receive funding for victim services programs and among the organizations that are ultimately funded, according to a report released Tuesday by the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. That lack of diversity continues all the way to the victims who receive services, the report found. Victim services in Colorado are mostly provided to white people, even though Black and Latino people are nationally more likely to be victims of crime. The glaring takeaway for us was the disparity in how the funding is administered and distributed. And the second glaring takeaway was the disparity as it relates to the decision makers on the boards and the commissions, the folks who are responsible for determining how this funding is allocated, said Justin Cooper, Deputy Director of the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. The Office for Victims Programs, which is part of the Colorado Department of Public Safety and distributes 95% of funding for victims' services in the state, is about 74% white, while the Crime Victim Services Advisory Board, which recommends which organizations receive grant money, is about 85% white, the report found. Meanwhile, in the 2019 fiscal year, the agency disbursed about $70 million in grants to various organizations. The organizations that were funded were also largely white-led and staffed by white employees, according to the report by the coalition, which is focused on reforming the state's justice system. In order to provide culturally competent services, you have to have staff and decision makers that reflect the population you are serving, Cooper said. What we are looking at in our state is not that. Kelly Kissel, unit manager for the Office of Victims Programs, said in a statement that the agency has already put in place or started to develop many of the report's recommended changes. Equitable treatment of all victims is critically important, and the Office for Victims Programs continues to analyze data and operationalize our findings to help ensure that marginalized communities have equal access to victim services and the agencies serving them have equal access to funding in Colorado, she said. Colorado's Office for Victims Programs helped just more than 116,000 victims of crime in the 2019 fiscal year, the report found. About 58% of those victims were white, 24% were Hispanic, and 8% were Black, according to the report, which noted that some victims' races were not recorded. The state agency uses census data as a benchmark for measuring its racial equity, according to the report. Colorado's overall population is about 65% white, 22% Hispanic or Latino, and 4.1% Black. However, that census data doesn't reflect that, nationally, people of color are victims of crime at higher rates than white people, the report notes. The authors called on the agencies to adjust their benchmarks. Kissel questioned the report's reliance on national crime data rather than Colorado-specific research. Serving Colorado's unique victims' needs is a top priority for the OVP, but using national crime data to draw conclusions in Colorado does not result in an accurate assessment or help address existing challenges for all victims of crime in our state, she said in the statement. Another state-run program, the Domestic Violence Program, which is under the Colorado Department of Human Services, was in charge of about $3 million in funding for victim services in the 2019 fiscal year, according to the report. Meanwhile, about 51% of the 25,000 people served were white, according to the report. Madeline Rubel, a spokeswoman for the Department of Human Services, said in a statement that the Domestic Violence Program is committed to finding ways to better reach and support vulnerable populations. The report did find one new program aimed specifically at serving people of color that has found success during its first 15 months, although it handles just a small fraction of the funding for victim services in the state. Community Crime Victim Services under the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment helped us 268 victims, but 84% were people of color, according to the report. The $1 million program, run by the Latino Coalition for Community Leadership, gave out 6 grants in the 2019 fiscal year, all to organizations run by people of color. Most of the organizations are largely staffed by non-white people as well, according to the report. The numbers are off the charts, Cooper said. They are showing there is an effective way of serving underserved victims of crime, especially men, Black men, people of color, and young adults. The report made a variety of recommendations for improving the diversity of both victim services organizations and the people they reach, including taking steps to include more people of color in the decisions about where grant money is awarded. The author said the state must invest more money into aggressively addressing the equity gap by prioritizing funding for diverse and community-based organizations. Leaders of color in the field emphasize the importance of having staff that look like the population served, the report said. While mainstream organizations absolutely can and should get better at serving communities of color, they cannot fully offer services to victims of color because they lack the experience of history and culture. In local briefs, Idaho Springs wildfire evacuation orders lifted. Byline, Idaho Springs. Firefighters have contained a 15-acre wildfire near Idaho Springs, as authorities lifted evacuation orders Monday for residents who were forced to leave their homes a day earlier. Clear Creek County Sheriff Rick Albers told reporters the Miner's Candle Fire began Sunday as a structure fire and destroyed 2 homes, a cabin, and a small number of outbuildings. About 20 firefighters were working the fire about 5 miles west of Idaho Springs, he said. The cause was under investigation. The fire was 50% contained Monday with full containment possibly by Wednesday evening, Albers said. Residents of about 2 dozen homes were ordered to evacuate as a fire erupted amid amid high winds Sunday and fed on extremely dry fuels. The fire was originally estimated at 20 acres, but overflights confirmed its size at 15, Elber said. In Jefferson County, hand crews expected to contain a 12-acre fire, the West Ranch Fire, west of the Denver suburban community of Ken Carroll, the Intercanyon Fire Protection District said Monday. No structures were threatened. That fire, too, erupted Sunday, and its cause is being investigated. Westminster police say officers shot, killed person in exchange of gunfire. A Westminster police officer shot and killed a person Sunday after police say the person first fired shots at the officer. The shooting happened near the intersection of 104th Avenue and Wadsworth Parkway, according to Westminster police. Officers were dispatched to a car crash, and when they arrived, a suspect ran away, according to police. Officer attempted contact with the suspect who fired at the officer, Westminster police said in a statement. The officer then returned fire and the person was killed, they said. A spokesperson for the police department did not immediately return a request for comment Sunday, and the age and gender of the person killed were not immediately clear. The officer who fired was not injured, police said. These were from staff and wire reports. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
Some 24,000 teenagers in foster care across the nation officially become adults each year. In Colorado, it happens on their 18th birthday. They're expected to move out and start their lives on their own. But Katie Fascinello with the group Illuminate Colorado says kids without a forever family face many challenges, including finding a job and a place to live, and the holiday season can be especially hard.
Many of these young people that leave the child welfare system without a strong support system in place face homelessness and substance use issues.
Within 2 to 4 years after leaving foster care, studies have shown that 4 in 10 young adults experienced homelessness or incarceration, and almost half did not graduate from high school or were unemployed. Colorado's county caseworkers can provide financial support for housing and education until young people turn 21, and Fascinello says resources are also available at unitedwaydenver.org. Michelle Mares with the Kemp Center says many young people who have aged out of foster care lack basic life skills, such as how to do laundry or cook dinner for themselves. She says adult volunteers can make a big difference just by being a reliable voice on the telephone or making time to meet up for coffee.
Mentorship is so important, and it is not a lifelong commitment. There are a lot of people out in our communities who are willing and able to share some time and space with our young adults.
Fascinello says Colorado's child welfare system is working to transition into a child and family well-being network. The emphasis has shifted to strengthening families facing economic hardships to ensure that kids don't end up exiting the system without a safety net.
When we look at universal preschool and access to child care, paid leave, those pieces are known to prevent child maltreatment. That's how we strengthen families. That's how we avoid children ending up without a family.
This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that vapes and e-cigarettes may not be as safe as you think? It is not harmless water vapor. The aerosol emitted from e-cigarettes is a mix of chemicals that may cause harm to human bodies. This includes nicotine, nanoparticles, heavy metals, and flavorings known to cause respiratory disease. It is not an FDA-approved cessation device. E-cigarettes are not approved for cessation of cigarettes at this time. Only approved nicotine products with counseling have been proven to help people quit all tobacco products for good. E-cigarettes are not regulated. At this time, there are no standard regulations for e-cigarette products. This means that the exact ingredients or how they are made are unknown. Nicotine is present in almost all products. Though some products may claim to be nicotine-free, no regulation means there is no way to show that these claims are true. Also, there are still chemicals in e-liquids that may be harmful to the human body. Nicotine is addictive. Using tobacco products has been considered a nasty habit for too long. The truth is that nicotine in tobacco products is addictive. It can change biology and, if left untreated, can last a lifetime. Nicotine can harm the developing brain. The brain is still developing until about the age of 25. Nicotine can disrupt brain development and cause impulsive behaviors and difficulty focusing. When young people use nicotine, they are susceptible to a lifetime of addiction. Flavors attract kids. Though some adults may enjoy using products flavored like cotton candy or gummy bears, many of the e-liquids are meant to taste like childhood favorites of young people. Big tobacco plays a role. Big tobacco companies, who have a history of putting sales above safety, own shares of many vape companies. This message was brought to you by the Tri-County Health Department. For more information, please visit tchd.org/e-cigs.